Why did you drop the first atom bomb?
My chief purpose was to end the war in victory, with the least possible loss of American lives. I never had any qualms about using it as an instrument that finally ended the war in which we'd had 250 or 300,000 of our youngsters killed and 700,000 of them maimed.
Oh, it went up so loud, it divided up the clouds, and the houses did vanish away. And a great ball of light filled the Japanese with pride. They must have thought it was their judgment day.
It was the feeling you have when all wars are over. Johnny was marching home, boys kissing girls. You've seen the photographs, they are accurate, of course, of the nurse being kissed, bent backwards by the boy somewhere on Times Square, but it could be on Main Street in any small town. I'm sure there was a blowing of horns everywhere as it was in Chicago. There was a getting drunk and boozing and happiness, and again, there was a quietness too. But it had something in addition. It had something to it that the other wars did not have. And that was what happened at Hiroshima. That was, there's a new weapon that eliminates, makes obsolete the front line. And now there ain't no home front, it's all front. And that is the new development. And that changed this celebration from all other celebrations in history.
This is Hiroshima Countdown with Studs Terkel. I'm Andrew Phillips.
It's the question of the nature of quantitative and qualitative change.
Philip Morrison. He designed the plutonium core for the Nagasaki bomb. Today, Philip Morrison is 70 years old, a professor of physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, small behind his desk, stacked with books and papers, piercing blue eyes, hair slightly long, a tiny gold-framed picture of Albert Einstein propped against a broken fragment of what must have been a huge plaster-cast globe of the Earth, rests on a wooden shelf.
So that change in scale makes an enormous change in how you have to regard things. Same thing is true the other way around for nuclear weapons. A nuclear weapon is simply gives you damage, physical damage, which nobody knows how to stop or even to mitigate, 1,000 or maybe 10,000 times cheaper than ever before.
Philip Morrison joined the cadre of atomic physicists that would build the atomic bomb. He was a young man in his mid-20s among scientists living through a miraculous era. It was the new physics, a confluence in history, scientific insight and freedom colliding with Nazi fanaticism and oppression, two powerful forces fusing, and an atomic bomb would be the result.
It was fundamental physics, very like art, as you would say, or very like philosophy, something like that, and much more like that from the present point of view. After all, in America, a large number of the leading persons in this kind of physics, especially in theoretical physics, were men of early middle age, 30s, 40s, who had been given their advanced training, not in the United States at all, but in Germany, and occasionally in Britain or Holland. Robert Oppenheimer, Ed Condon. You could name quite a few.
But in the meantime, the Depression in Europe had its effect. The restlessness, the despair, the rage of many, and along comes a demagogue, he talks very eloquently and wildly, and he writes Mein Kampf, and as Hitler, and he hits something, a deep-seated racism that is there. I imagine all people, certainly there at the time, needed a scapegoat. You always need a scapegoat, the scapegoat of the goddamn Bolsheviks and the Jews. So all this is going on. Of course, it's perfect, this fertile ground for someone like Hitler.
You see these dictators on their pedestals, surrounded by the bayonets of their soldiers and the truncheons of their police. On all sides, they are guarded by masses of armed men. Cannons, airplanes, fortifications, and the like.
Then I remember the scientists most responsible for the idea, those close to Einstein, Leo Szilard, who's the one who figured Einstein is the only man who can convince Roosevelt to work on this when they thought the Germans were going to have it.
In the middle 1930s, Hungarian physicist Leo Szilard moved from Germany to Britain, where he first thought of a nuclear chain reaction. Then in January 1939, came news of uranium fission, the splitting of the atom. Now in America, Szilard was appalled by the lack of official interest in this development. He foresaw the possibility of extremely powerful bombs of a new type. In Germany, the export of uranium from Czechoslovakian mines taken over by the Nazis had suddenly stopped. Apparently, the Germans were also thinking of a bomb. Edward Teller, like fellow Hungarian Szilard, had recently arrived in America.
One of my good friends was the man whose efforts led to the beginning of the Manhattan Project, Leo Szilard. He had ideas even before the discovery of fission about the general way in which nuclear energy will be used. He is the person who persuaded Einstein to write a letter to Roosevelt in order to start the Manhattan Project. And I might say that my first appearance in history was when I acted as Szilard's chauffeur to take him out to the end of Long Island to get that famous letter signed.
I brought a letter of Dr. Einstein, dated August 2nd, 1939,
Alexander Sachs. Szilard gave him the letter, urging Sachs to take it to President Roosevelt. It would be almost 2 months before the president saw that letter. War in Europe had already broken out. When finally they did meet early one morning, Alexander Sachs shrewdly told his president a parable, how the American inventor, Robert Fulton, had tried to sell his steamboat concept to Napoleon, but how the Frenchman had refused Fulton's suggestion. Sachs suggested to Roosevelt that had Napoleon taken up Fulton's idea, Britain would probably have been invaded by the French. The analogy was not lost on Roosevelt.
The Nazis don't develop a bomb to blow us up, and that free American research gives us that bomb and that energy ahead of anybody. And then proceeded to start the organization that eventually produced the atomic bomb.
President Roosevelt and Alexander Sachs toasted the birth of the Manhattan Project with Napoleon brandy. It requires action, said the president, and so began the $2 billion Manhattan Project, so called because its first office happened to be in New York City. But the project began slowly. The first thing to do? Prove that a controlled chain reaction was possible. In the meantime, the situation in Europe was growing more serious.
We Americans of today, together with our allies, are passing through a period of supreme test. It is a test of our courage, of our resolve.
The British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years. Men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Hitler invaded the lowlands.
Edward Teller.
On that day, I heard one and only time Roosevelt give a talk to a Pan-American Scientific Congress in which I was participating. He talked about the responsibility of scientists, that we are blamed for all these terrible weapons. And then he said, but I'm telling you, if you are not going to work on weapons now, freedom will not survive. I had a strange feeling. But he was talking to me, because the fact was that Einstein's letter must have been in his mind. And in that hall where there were thousands of people, probably Roosevelt and I were the only ones aware of the coming nuclear weapons.
It would be another 2 years before America really got serious about the new weapon. The funds began to flow in earnest the day before Pearl Harbor. Retired Admiral Jean LaRocque.
The day the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, I was assigned to the USS McDonough as an ensign. And I was en route to my ship on a Sunday morning when we first saw the Japanese planes circling Pearl Harbor, 5-6 miles ahead. As we approached the base at Pearl Harbor, we were actually strafed. We drove off the side of the road, and then continued our journey, commandeered a boat when we got to the landing, and went out to our ship. The scene at Pearl Harbor and in the airfield at Hickam Field was absolutely one of mad bedlam. There were fires, there was oil on the water, there were explosions. No one obviously was in charge. We were completely disorganized, and we felt perhaps that the Japanese were over the horizon about to make a landing. We were one of total shock.
Johnny was a soldier boy who never looked for scraps, but this young buckaroo was Yankee through and through. Then Johnny heard our country's call to arms against the Japs, and as he marched away, his buddies heard him say...
And now it was a race, not only with the Germans, but with the Japanese. Both countries, as well as the Soviets, had plans for atomic weapons following the discovery of fission, but it was America that committed the resources. America, with its hundreds of universities and institutions, provided opportunities to the intellectual refugees of Europe, scientists who proved so essential to the bomb's development. The men who led this polyglot group were General Leslie R. Groves, a robust, overweight, bulldozing army engineer, and the tall, enigmatic, brilliant theoretical physicist, J. Robert Oppenheimer.
I had a very close relationship with Robert Oppenheimer. In some ways, he was my intellectual mentor, almost my father. Of course, he was a remarkable man. He was an extraordinarily cultivated man, devoted to learning, of which science he thought was the most appropriate, most modern, most exciting part. Was an amateur student of Sanskrit, and of course, he read the European languages, and he was as familiar with the French poets as he was with mathematics.
In June 1942, Oppenheimer was appointed director of Project Y. This group of scientists would design the new atomic bomb. In the fall of that year, he and Groves chose the laboratory site, Los Alamos, high in the mountains of New Mexico. Isolation was important because secrecy was paramount. Living conditions were primitive, but spirit and drive pushed these scientists to build a bomb before the enemy. Ellen Flanders was a young high school girl at the time. Her father worked on the project. She remembers babysitting for the Oppenheimers and the Tellers, and sometimes playing her violin with Edward Teller, who was an accomplished pianist.
I knew him and his wife quite well. In fact, I too played with Teller because I played the violin. And we played some violin sonatas together. And I took care of his child and knew the family quite well.
Was he a good pianist, Teller?
He was inclined to super vitality in music as in everything else. People said about him that when he was in the laboratory, in his scientific work, he would come up with an incredible number of ideas, and his assistants had to run around with buckets and catch them all, and they would not all be good, but he was always a fountain of ideas. And he played that way on the piano also. It was said of Fermi that he would come out with only one idea, and it would be right.
Is victory a sweet dish, or isn't it? And how do you think those lights look in Europe after 5 years of blackout going on to six? Rather pretty good. Pretty good, sister.
VE Day, first day, May 8th, 1945, and it was the end of the European theater of war, because it was Hitler rather than Japan. And so when Hitler was beaten and killed himself in the bunker and the war is over and the Americans met the Russians at the Elba, my memory is of this marvelous radio program that Norman Corwin wrote for this occasion for CBS called On a Note of Triumph. It's a remarkable program.
We're gonna tell the postman next time he comes around that Mr. Hitler's new address is the Berlin Burying Ground.
Of course, there was excitement in the streets and euphoria and all sorts of celebrations. But the Pacific Theater was still there. And it was still there. And there was still this talk about Americans having to go there, about the Japanese being stubborn, fighting to the last man. And then, of course, came the bomb.
We're standing in front of the first atomic bomber, the Enola Gay, a storied B-29 which carried the revolutionary atomic bomb to the enemy. Gathered here are a group of...
The crews of the two B-29s, the largest bombers in the U.S. Air Force of the day, proudly tell their story in this official Air Force recording in Guam, August 1945.
And that the new bomb we carried would be a great help in shortening the war.
And all of us who have had a part in its development and in carrying out its use should dedicate our strength, our wealth, our brains, and even our very lives to see that it is always used for good and never for evil.
We're gonna have to slap the dirty little Jap, and Uncle Sam's the guy who can do it. We'll skin that streak of yellow from the sneaky little fella, and he'll...
The bomber group was called the 509th. It comprised over 1,000 men and 18 B-29s plus support transport aircraft. Their base in the Pacific was tiny Tinian Island, 10 miles long, 5 miles wide, less than 1,500 miles from Tokyo, the closest base America could get at that time. Tinian had the largest operational runway in the world, carved out of the shimmering white coral. Nobody but those in charge and 12 civilian scientists from Los Alamos knew why they were there, why the 509th flew no regular firebomb raids on Japan. Into the air, the secret rose. Where they're going, nobody knows. Tomorrow they'll return again, but we'll never know where they've been, went a sarcastic poem mimeographed and circulated around Tinian. Physicist Philip Morrison was on Tinian Island at that time.
You have to imagine it was a fantastic base. You have no idea. I don't think anybody who wasn't there, who didn't read about it particularly, would understand what it was. It was a city of 120,000 people, maybe. All young men. Maybe 2,000 women total.
Were you there when the bomber crews took off?
The combat bomb crew?
Yeah, when Tibbets
and
Sweeney took off.
Oh, yes, of course. Mm-hmm.
Could you... You must have...
Yes, I was responsible for loading the Nagasaki bomb, putting it together on Tinian and getting it loaded onto the aircraft. My responsibility extended really only to the nuclear core. And then somebody else had the high explosive, and somebody else had the firing set, and somebody else had the loading job. But where several groups from Los Alamos went there especially to be in charge of these two bombs. Tibbets dropped the Hiroshima bomb. That wasn't my baby, but I was just a bystander. But the Nagasaki bomb, I was directly involved.
Now, to answer your question, regrets, no. I must say that I have absolutely no regrets, and that has to be understood in the context of what the thinking was in the period 1941 to 45.
Commander Paul Tibbets was in charge of the 509th bomber group. He called his B-29 bomber Enola Gay after his mother. Today, Tibbets is president of Executive Jet Aviation, a prestigious air charter company based in Columbus, Ohio. On his office wall is a picture of the actors and the crew who played in the Hollywood film about his famous flight, and a blue pennant from the 509th. The crest is a winged mushroom cloud.
Regretfully, war is a terrible thing. Let's just stop the regrets there. Personally speaking, no, I did what I was supposed to do. I think I did it quite well. As a result, I accomplished what I was convinced I would accomplish, which was stop the war and save lives.
Do you fly sometimes still?
Yeah, I still keep my hand in. I like to fly, and it'll be a sad day when I can't.
And how old are you?
Well, I've had my 70th birthday. I think it's an expression of freedom that nothing else gives you. Because when you're up there with that airplane, you're free as a bird, so to speak. And you're the master of your own destiny up there, with certain exceptions that the good Lord takes over. But I mean, other than that, no. It's just, I don't know. There's a certain... feeling that I got from it years ago, and back when I had the bomb project.
This is one in a series of interviews conducted by the Air Force Historical Division. Today we are interviewing Brigadier General Paul W. Tibbets, Jr., who is retiring...
They were definitely military targets, there was no question about that. And they offered such a, well, you could almost say a classroom experiment, as far as being able to determine later the bomb damage. These were good virgin targets, and they were ideal for the purpose that we wanted to use them for.
The consideration of targets would be Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Niigata, Kakura, and there's one more that I don't remember. The 20th Air Force had been told they would not attack those targets under any circumstances. In other words, the ground was laid.
As well as these targets, Kyoto, Japan's ancient capital, was strongly recommended by the man with overall control of the bomb project, General Leslie Groves. But Secretary of War Henry Stimson, approaching 80 years of age, would not have it. He'd visited Kyoto with his wife in the 20s and had enjoyed the city's cultural riches. It was a city of great religious significance to the Japanese, and Stimson felt Kyoto's destruction would damage America's post-war stature.
The selection of the targets in the month of May 1945 was actually done by the intelligence community in headquarters U.S. Air Force. The requirements given to them was, you will select cities that have military targets in them. And they also selected the type of terrain that they wanted. They also were interested in the type of construction that they could expect to run into. Because in reality, not only was this a military mission, but it was also of extreme scientific importance, because they wanted to know what a weapon of this type could do against reinforced concrete, what it could do against steel, what it would do against anything that was in the building materials line. It had to be something that had not been attacked by the 20th Air Force up to that time. Call it virgin targets, undamaged, unhurt by any other type of an explosive or munition.
I knew the type of bomb we were working on.
Charles Sweeney flew with Tibbets in an observer aircraft to witness the bombing of Hiroshima. 3 days later, he would lead his crew first to Kakura, the primary target for the second bomb, and then to Nagasaki. Kakura was clouded in that day.
As he was talking, he picked up a handful of earth. He said, basically what we're working on is a single bomb that will turn a whole city into this. And he just tossed a handful of sand into the air.
As the Allies moved north towards Japan, the pressure to complete work on the atomic bomb grew even more intense. It was already too late to drop it on the Germans. Would the war end before it could be used on Japan? Should there be a demonstration? The politicians and the scientists wrestled with these questions. Vannevar Bush and James Conant composed a memorandum for President Roosevelt, and historian Alice Kimball Smith explained its content at this 40th anniversary gathering of the first chain reaction at the University of Chicago. Alice Kimball Smith.
The Bush-Conant memorandum also suggested demonstrating the bomb in an uninhabited area, though they abandoned this idea as technical uncertainties in bomb design persisted. But a non-military demonstration was being widely discussed in the early months, weeks of 1945, not only in the light of Germany's imminent defeat, but in the realization that most of the people who were going to meet in a few weeks in San Francisco in April to discuss the organization of the United Nations didn't know about the bomb. In fact, the U.S. Secretary of State had only just been told about it in preparation for the meeting.
The scientist who'd first realized the possibility of a bomb, Leo Szilard, was now afraid to see his idea reach fruition. With some colleagues, he set about preparing a memorandum for President Roosevelt.
And he'd obtained an appointment with the president for May 2nd, when the president died on April 12th. Truman was too busy to see Szilard and sent him to his personal advisor, James F. Burns, who would later be his Secretary of State. For all Szilard's self-confidence in intellectual matters, he was well aware that his manner was not always ingratiating and that his foreign accent didn't always make the most favorable impression upon American officials. Burns knew about the bomb, but the three men were terribly shocked by his apparent lack of appreciation and understanding of it. And Burns, on his side, was very much antagonized by Szilard's presumption in thinking that he and other scientists ought to go and talk directly to the cabinet.
Now, Truman is going to Potsdam. He meets with Stalin and the rest of them over there, Churchill and whatnot, and they have the meeting. Truman is quite aware, and he knows that he's going to have to make the decision to drop the bomb.
It was a pivotal moment in history. On July 16th, the first atomic bomb had exploded at Alamogordo in the New Mexico desert. And on July 17th, a day later, the Potsdam Conference began. Stalin, Churchill and Truman faced each other to negotiate the coming peace. The coded message Truman received at Potsdam through Stimson read in part, "The little boy is as husky as his big brother. The test was a success." Churchill was told. Stalin was not. Truman was tremendously pepped up, noted Stimson in his diary. He was a changed man, said Churchill, and he told the Russians just where to get off and generally bossed the whole meeting. Back on Tinian Island, the next phase was set.
When Truman is on the way back to the United States aboard a cruiser, he sends word into Washington, which is relayed out to us, because he knows we're ready. He's advised code-wise. He's advised we're ready to go, which allowed us to select the 6th day of August as the day we wanted to go to Hiroshima. The thing went exactly like we had pre-planned it to go.
We had a briefing the afternoon of August 5th, the day before the mission was going to take place. And there, the tactics that we would use were explained to us by Colonel Tibbetts. If I recall correctly, he also told those participating crews what we were going to do for the first time. And as I recall, he said that anybody who didn't want to become involved could then and there back out with no prejudice.
And we were prepared and did take off from Tinian Island with the bomb on board at approximately 2 a.m. Tinian time on the morning of the 6th day of August. I had sent ahead of me three airplanes, one to observe the weather over Hiroshima, one to observe it over Nagasaki, and one to observe it over Kakura. Because as I approached the Japanese shoreline, I could go to any one of those three targets depending